General Sun arrived last week to assume his duties. After the Glavny Prothnik, the main enemy, the Chinese termiti, these termites, are the biggest threat to the Rodina in the future, continued Gorelikov, looking sideways at Dominika. You know counterintelligence, you have winning ways, so see what this rice-eater has to say, what he has under his tongue. The president wants to know how we can benefit. Winning ways, thought Dominika. I'm sure you're referring to my ops skills. Do you think he is susceptible? Asked Dominika. If he has predilections, they will become apparent in time, said Gorelikov casually. Men, women, children, spirits, drugs, gambling, tasting pain or inflicting it. We'll know soon enough. Dominika smiled knowingly, hiding her contempt. My Rodina, land of black earth and fragrant pines, my country, transformed by you heroes into a back-alley clearinghouse of vice. Even as we watch the dragon carefully, said Gorelikov, China may be useful in depleting U.S. influence on a second front. He bent to prepare another fritter for Dominika, but she held up a polite hand in refusal. China could be very useful, said Gorelikov, counting on his fingers. Alternate petroleum markets, military equipment sales, cyber operations against American infrastructure, a tangible challenge to U.S. Navy hegemony in the Pacific, a cooperative intelligence with Beijing could potentially be of great benefit. Naturally, you will assess the feasibility of intelligence operations against these Maoists here, in Beijing, and in Hong Kong. I will run traces on General Sun. Perhaps something useful will appear. Gorelikov shook his head. We're doing this on our own, you and I. Let's see where this takes us. Dominika realized that she was becoming Putin's personal operational fixer. Another success, with Chinese liaison, for instance, would almost certainly win her the directorship of SVR. She took another swing at Magnet. The president mentioned Shlikov's sensitive case. What is the status of that? Gorelikov smiled. All in good time, he said. There may not be time to wait before your damned mole reads my name, Dominika thought. Dominika met the MSS general for lunch at the White Rabbit, the internationally acclaimed restaurant on the rooftop 16th floor of the Smolensk Passage building in the Arbat, on Smolenskaya Square, the long dining room completely under a curved glass roof, with breathtaking views of the Moskva River and Stalin's looming Gothic Ministry of Foreign Affairs skyscraper. The restaurant interior was a dreamland of extravagant artwork hung every which way, brightly colored couches, and a neon-lit bar, all under the scudding afternoon clouds of early summer. Dominika chose a dark chalk-striped suit with a white blouse buttoned at the neck, dark stockings, and black flats. No cleavage or come-fuck-me heels today. She was already seated at a choice corner table for five at the end of the room, against the downward sweep of the clear canopy when General Sun appeared by the maitre d' station. He was accompanied by a tall young man who scanned the room, leaned to whisper in the general's ear, and pointed at Dominika. Bodyguard. Sun came down the two steps and made his way alone across the dining room between the tables. The young man remained at the entrance, never taking his eyes off the general. General Sun was short and stout, in his 60s with a smooth, flat face and jet black hair, no doubt dyed. Roomy black eyes under upward-arching eyebrows gave him a perpetual quizzical look, as if he were struggling to understand what was being said to him. There was a canary-yellow halo around his head, signaling deceit, calculation, disingenuousness. He stood at the table and bowed slightly, then offered his hand in a mild, fleeting handshake. He was dressed in a pearl-gray suit, with a starched white shirt and a muted striped tie. "It is a pleasure to meet you, Colonel," said Sun, in heavily accented English. He sat across the table from her, unrolled his spotless linen napkin, and put it on his lap. At the academy, they would have recommended he take the seat next to her to establish a connection, to position himself inside her space, but that's what aggressive SVR Russians would do. Cautious and introverted Chinese officials, in full defensive mode in the Russian capital, would be different. In contrast, Dominika knew Nate would scoot his chair close so their knees were touching, and drape his arm across the back of her chair. But what else could you expect from Nekulturn the Americans? Nate intruding into her thoughts again. Are you enjoying Moscow, General? Said Dominika. Are you in your apartment? She knew all Chinese embassy diplomats had strict rules and were forced to live kaksaledka vibochki, packed like herrings in the barrel in prefab high-rises on the embassy's 5-acre walled compound on Druzhby Street near Moscow State University. I am fortunate to have been assigned a comfortable flat in a large building on Minskaya Ulitsa in the diplomatic quarter, not far from the embassy. I can walk when the weather permits, said General Sun. My assistant and housekeeper live with me. Interesting. He's allowed to live off-compound, very unusual. Staying loose to be able to operate in Moscow? Living apart also means we can get to him, if we eventually see an opening. Welcome to Moscow. Your comely neighbor lady might need to borrow a cup of sparrow sugar some evening, Dominika thought. I trust that soon we can host you at headquarters in Yasenevo, said Dominika. Delighted, said General Sun, reserved. I understand your service is interested in expanding cooperation, said Dominika. Most assuredly, said Sun. My organization, I apologize for the long title, the Zhonghua Renmin Gonghui Guo Guozhia Anquanbu, the Ministry of State Security, is especially interested in your services' recognized expertise in counterintelligence. As you are chief of that department, we wish to learn from you. He bowed from his seat. Was the MSS worried about a specific CI problem? She knew SVR officers in the Beijing Residentura were trolling for elusive Chinese contacts, but Dominika was not aware of any major SVR operations currently running against China. Maybe her CIA colleagues were causing trouble. This is good. Really good, she thought. Dominika could exploit this liaison relationship on three levels. She would elicit MSS counterintelligence philosophy and techniques. She could pass desinformatia, disinformation, to Beijing about Russian intentions toward China. Korolikov would like that. And she would report it all to Benford and Nate. General Sun seemed mild and polite, but her instincts told her, like with Korolikov, not to underestimate him. Benford sat at a conference table in headquarters with Tom Forsythe, Nate Nash, and Lucius Westfall. Coffee cups, files, folders, and pads of paper literally covered the table. The empty chair at the end of the small table reminded them of Gable, and they felt his presence in the room. They wished he were with them, for this was a desperate gathering, a mole hunt. At Benford's behest, Westfall and Nash had cautiously researched the backgrounds, without approvals from the office of the acting director, of the three candidates for the new director, a violation of at least a dozen agency regulations, if not a handful of federal ones. They were all complicit by their presence in this room. We screened for three criteria, said Westfall. Substantive access to the U.S. Navy railgun program, continuing access of interest to the Russians for approximately the last 5 years, and the last category, which is subjective vulnerability motivation inclination. You'll have to decide yourselves. Why 5 years? Said Benford. Diva reported that Magnet's been in harness for at least 12 years. Westfall swallowed. We figured if we identify 5 years of access, we get an indication. Besides, Magnet may have been dormant or on ice for a couple of years. Benford nodded. As you report on your findings, and if it does not tax your millennial intellects, remember we are looking as hard for reasons to exclude anyone of the three as a suspect as we are for incriminating evidence. The Russians cannot be running all three of them, and we don't have much time. Okay, Senator Feigenbaum's been on the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees for 20 years, said Westfall. She voted to fund the railgun through the development process and can request any information from the Navy anytime she wants. Motivation? Said Forsythe. She's a U.S. senator, for Christ's sakes. Debatable, said Nate. She's traveled a lot overseas in her career, including lots of contacts with the Soviets. Maybe she's retiring soon, wants a cabinet job. We thought maybe she's building a nest egg. But we found out she doesn't need a nest egg, said Westfall. We did a full financial dive on all the candidates. The senator has $30 million in the bank and in real estate. Don't discount the amassing of title and power, said Benford. It's what makes the whole Congress tick, the ultimate aphrodisiac among a large herd of narcissists. We know the senator hates CIA's guts, said Westfall. Maybe the Kremlin is paying her to bring down the agency, said Benford. She'd like to do that, her and her butt-boy Farbison. Forsyth didn't buy it, but motioned Westfall to continue. Next, we have Vice Admiral Audrey Rowland. She's actually been running the railgun project since it started. Now she's running all the Navy labs with science and weapons and stealth stuff the Russians would love to steal. Motivation? Asked Nate. She's the cleanest of the bunch, said Westfall. Third star, medals, physics brain, poster girl for the Navy. She stays at home, too. No time at all with the fleet at sea. Military pension when she retires. Hobbies, vices, habits, addictions, vulnerabilities? Asked Forsyth, the case officer looking for a handle. Westfall shook his head. Nothing except the China doll heads, he said. What in God's name is that? Said Forsyth. The Admiral is a major collector. She's even mentioned on some websites. Marvelous, said Benford. But what are they? Tell me they're from Russia, perhaps. No, said Westfall. You know those antique porcelain dolls from Victorian Britain or 19th century Germany with those creepy stares and Cupid's bow mouths and rouged fever cheeks? Not the whole dolls, not the antique dresses. The Admiral just collects the heads. She's got hundreds of them, all on some shelf, staring. At this point, Marty Gable would make a crack about inflatable love dolls, said Benford. They were all quiet for a second. Frigging dolls. Ask the shrinks what it means, said Nate. Maybe the Admiral's got a secret life. With that hair? Said Benford. She looks like Martha Washington. That comment is mildly unpatriotic, said Nate. Benford swiped the air as if batting gnats. It doesn't matter how clean the Admiral seems. Don't underestimate military culture, said Forsyth. Advancement is everything, especially for women in the services. Bringing military discipline to a civilian agency might appeal to her scientific mind. For flag rank officers, finding a job with influence after retirement is important. It could be a lot of factors. I still think the Admiral comes in as the cleanest of the bunch, said Westfall. I can't see her meeting with the Russians and hiding blood diamonds under the floorboards. What about the third guy? Snapped Benford. The ambassador? Sort of a lightweight, but during his 4 years in Embassy Rome, he was reading plenty of classified cables. Now he's on the intelligence working group, which gives him moderate access the Russians would want. Lots of business travel overseas for years, including commodities deals in Belarus, so that's a red flag. He was in Hollywood once and likes money. He's worth around $100 million, so maybe becoming director is just an ego thing. But no access to the railgun, right? We can cross him off, said Forsyth. Westfall handed him a sheet of paper. That's what I thought, he said. But it happens that he worked on a 5-year Navy railgun contract because his precious metals company manufactured beryllium oxide ceramic heat diffusers for the magnetic rails. They get hot with all that juice running through them, and Ambassador Tommy Vano knows railgun design intimately. He made another bundle on the contract donated to the Wright campaign. He's moderately liberal, but he looks out for himself, and became an ambassador. Who thinks he can run CIA, Christ? So any of the three could be magnet, said Forsyth. The Admiral's least likely for reasons of motive and ideology, are we agreed? And there's another briefing tomorrow. The acting director wants Russia cases to be briefed this time. We're not opening our restricted cases to these fuckers, Benford said. Not smart, Simon, said Forsyth. The director would love to take you down as he walks out the door. I will not brief any of the three on Diva. She would be dead in a week. There was silence at the table until Benford raised his head. I need to speak to Nash. May we reconvene in 2 hours? Thank you. The conference room cleared quickly. Benford stared at Nash for a full minute. Please do not utter a word until I finish speaking. Benford was always telling people not to speak, but the tone in his voice this time told Nash he was waltzing on the rim of the volcano. Benford handed him a cable from Moscow, a translation of a note Dominica had passed to Ricky Walters during a dangerous personal meeting. She had written that the death of Gable had affected her deeply, and that she would curtail personal meetings until such time as she could be resupplied with Shrak. She would, of course, inform colleagues whenever she was in the West to arrange meetings then, but no more inside contact. I advised you to keep Marty's death from her, given her attachment to him. I have consulted the Gregorian, Julian, and Coptic calendars and conclude there is not enough time before the next solstice for me to enumerate the ways you have been stupid, said Benford, baring his teeth and wearing his Fall of Ancient Rome face, the one the Emperor used while watching Christians in the Colosseum being fed to lions. His unblinking eyes held Nate's, something rarely seen with Benford, and it signaled real danger. That I acquiesced in letting you develop a romantic attachment to a sensitive asset was an abrogation of my personal and professional standards and a failure on my part as an operational manager. This was bad. He had not only fucked up personally, but also, Nate now realized, caused Benford professional vexation. He wondered if the day would end with his being walked out of the headquarters building, escorted by two crew-cut linebackers from the Office of Security in blue blazers who would yank his ID badge off his lapel as the automatic doors slid open to welcome him to a sunny civilian world without spies and secrets, and without Dominica. "So now, we must contemplate the scale of your fuck-up," continued Benford. "Not only have you resolutely shagged this agency's premier penetration of the Kremlin with all that pretends, but you could not or would not keep devastating news from her with the result you now hold in your hands. A cessation of timely reporting from her while a Russian mole is possibly to be named director of this agency." Nate held his breath. He didn't dare offer an explanation. "It is an axiom of our profession that this work is experiential. One is not born to it. One only becomes more skillful with time. In the arc of your semen-roiled career, you can boast of notable accomplishments and now of an elephantine failure. The question I am asking myself is whether redemption is possible. Redemption is not automatic. A second chance is given only if merited. God knows we have suffered abject, irredeemable fellows in our service, Gondorf and Javine, the self-congratulatory directors who only read of operations but never manage them." Benford scowled and thought. Behind him was a photograph of a snow-blasted wall with an inverted V marked in chalk on the masonry, a Moscow signal site from the 1960s. "Are you redeemable, Nash?" said Benford. "Or more to the point, are you worth redeeming?" Benford stared at Nate for 20 seconds, testing him, assessing his nerves. "Speak," he said. "Okay, dickhead, the most important sentence of the rest of your life," thought Nate. "Simon, Marty Gable once told me an officer in the service can never achieve greatness until he or she failed big at least once. I'm not going to explain my mistakes to you because you know what the situation is between me and Diva. I'm committed to her and to this job. You know what I've done and what I can still do if you give me a chance. You asked whether I'm worth redeeming. Well, Simon, you fucking tell me. But with all respect, if you give up on me, you're a bigger asshole than everyone thinks you are. I'm ready to go to work and do any job, so you decide. Do I stay or are you kicking me out?" Nate meant what he said, but would the ever-profane Simon swallow the insubordination? Nate thought it probably would come down to what Benford had for lunch that day. Nate waited for the hammer to drop. Benford ran fingers through already tousled hair. "You have balls talking to me like that. Jesus, you sound like Al Gore," he said. "All right, now get out of here and get to work." Carrot fritter with yogurt sauce. Squeeze all the water out of grated zucchini and carrots and mix them with chopped scallions, parsley, dill, and garlic. Add flour and egg to make a wet paste and season. Form a large spoonful of the mixture into a ball and press a pitted brine-soaked olive, Kalamata, Picholine, or Niçoise, into the center. Slightly flatten the fritter in a pan and fry in olive oil until golden brown. Serve hot with yogurt sauce. Stir pureed garlic, red wine vinegar, and olive oil into yogurt. Chapter 23, A Bit of Groan and Grunt. This is how Simon Benford sent Nathaniel Nash to the Orient. At first, Nate thought the temporary assignment was, besides a blessed reprieve, a form of geographical exile to keep him separated from Dominica. But the next day, when he went with analyst Lucius Westfall to meet Elwood Holder, the chief of China operations, and they were briefed on what had happened in Hong Kong, he knew there was a real clam bake on, an opportunity so astronomically lucrative that even Benford later agreed that the counterintelligence risks of operating inside Chinese territory were outweighed by the potential gains. Holder was a 35-year veteran of China Ops, a plank owner, a Daiban, an esteemed Taipan, one of the agency's original China hands who spoke fluent Mandarin and wrote both simplified and traditional Chinese with pen or brush. His office walls were decorated with rice paper banners covered in spidery flowing logograms that Holder himself had painted. Lucius admired a particularly elaborate scroll. "Sun Tzu, 5th century B.C., said Holder, running his finger down the paper. "In all military affairs, none is more valuable than the spy. None should be more liberally rewarded than the spy, and none should work with greater secrecy than the spy." He returned to his desk, sat down, and leaned back in his chair. "Which one of you is Nash?" Nate nodded. Holder looked at Westfall. "And you're Benford's new PA from the DI? Good luck with that, and welcome to the Ops Directorate. You'll note General Tzu did not say, in all military affairs, none is more valuable than the analyst, but at least you're working with the Dark Prince now." Lucius said nothing. He was getting used to the jockstrap patois on this side of the building. Holder was short and stocky, with thinning sandy hair and merry blue eyes behind octagonal wire-rimmed glasses, eyes that missed nothing and stopped twinkling when he started talking about taking scalps, recruiting human sources, something he had frequently done around the world from the Taiwan Straits to the Tiber. Holder's fabled recruitment in 1985 was of a 30-year-old telephone technician in the Secretariat of the Communist Party of China. In exchange for VCR tapes of all 31 Elvis Presley films and a signed photograph of Anne Margaret, he identified the junction box in Beijing serving the Zhuangshan, the encrypted internal telephone system of the 12th Central Politburo. This resulted in the bugging of the line, which produced a stream of astounding code word intelligence for 36 months. Hong Kong station's been burning up the wires for a week, a dozen immediate restricted handling cables, said Holder. COS Hong Kong is an old whore, a top pro, knows China like the back of his hand, names Barnabas Burns. By the way, do not ever call him Barn, for short. He hates the nickname Barn Burns. The local Hong Kong ASIS rep, the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, called on Burns and made an urgent proposal for a joint op. Seems they've been looking for 6 months at a high-ranking general in the PLA, People's Liberation Army, a Zhang Jiang, a middle general, equivalent to lieutenant general. This Chinese general, named Tan Feren, comes from Guangzhou in the south. But he's a big noise in the Zhongguo Renmin Zhaifengjun Huozhanjun, the People's Liberation Army Rocket Force, PLARF for short, a top intelligence target for years. The PLARF owns all Chinese land-based and submarine-launched ballistic missiles and maintains their nukes, the whole deal. Holder read from a black-striped folder. The Aussies, to their delight, discovered that General Tan likes to gamble in the casinos of Macau. He's addicted, said Holder. There's widespread corruption in the PLA. You get general's rank by shelling out $500,000, and once they pin on your stars, you stand to make three times that from skimming contracts and from kickbacks. They're all dirty as hell. He rubbed his hands together as if he were smelling hot and sour soup on the stove. Tan secretly has been gambling with and losing official army funds. The Aussies figure he's $1 million in the hole. Beijing finds out, they'll stand him against a wall and shoot him. How do they know how much he's lost? Said Westfall. ASIS is a small service, but aggressive. They have ears in all the casinos. Gaming in Macau is bigger than in Vegas, and they have it covered. They say Tan is scared to death and desperate, and they want us to bankroll the pitch. We give the general the cash to replenish his cash box, and he starts reporting to us on the PLARF. And we share in the take, said Nate. It's a lot of money. He worth it? We'd pay twice that. The Chinese say, Andingji, to push a nail, to recruit a source inside their rocket forces. Real strategic intel. Will he go for it? Said Nate. Holder nodded. It starts spying or get the chop, but there's a problem. Asus says the general is a real Chi-Com, a diehard, a true believer. He won't accept if the pitch comes from the West, especially the United States. It's complicated, all wrapped up in Miam-Zi, loss of face, reputation, shame. Seems like he's not in a position to be picky, said Westfall. You'd think so. But I've seen them walk away over saving face, even if it means they go to prison later, said Holder. Lost a few good recruitments myself by trying to muscle them, believe me. So how do we sugarcoat it? Said Nate. Holder pointed at him. That's where you come in. Benford volunteered you, he said. So Benford already had me scoped for the job while he talked about redemption, thought Nate. He smiled to himself. We ran traces based on ASUS info, said Holder. General Tan was a military attaché in Moscow in the 90s, said Holder. He speaks some Russian and likes Russians. There's a faction in the PLA that still buys into the Sino-Russian friendship bullshit, and he's one of them. What am I hearing? Said Nate. A false flag? That's right, said Holder. You pitched Tan and Macau as a friendly SVR officer offering to discreetly help out an ally in exchange for PLARF secrets. The Aussies don't have a fluent Russian speaker who could pull this off. Benford tells me you speak like a native. Nate flashed back to when he had played a Russian reports officer with Dominica. It had been her idea, with an Iranian scientist in Vienna, a million years ago. I speak it pretty well, said Nate. You gotta speak it better than pretty fucking well, said Holder. General Tan smells CIA and he's out the window. MSS calls it Da Kao Jingji, beating the grass and startling the snake, telegraphing your intent. We want to avoid that. I'll try my best, said Nate. Is ASUS cool with me making the pitch? COS floated the idea to ASUS of using you as a Russian, and they liked it, said Holder, smiling. We hide the Western hand, Tan saves face, and we bag a sensitive source inside the PLARF. Epic once-in-a-decade recruitment. He loves this wilderness of mirrors shit as much as Benford, thought Nate. There's the small matter of pitching a Chinese lieutenant general in Chinese-controlled Macau, said Westfall, the innately practical analyst in him showing. The Aussies have an access agent in the casino who's been buttering the general, said Holder. They can get him to a quiet restaurant on the beach out of town. It's not that tight operationally. Macau is nothing but casinos, a special administrative region under the control of the Guangzhou MSS, and they thumb their nose at Beijing. They don't do anything too squirrely to upset the tourist industry. They all make money on the side. As long as they're not watching the general already, we probably can swing it, said Nate. If he says yes, how do we handle him? Just get him into harness and we'll do the rest, said Holder obliquely, which suggested to Nash that Holder already had inside handlers in Beijing. They didn't have a need to know. An ASUS case officer in Hong Kong will watch your fanny. Westfall stirred in his seat. I know I'm new to this and all, but I have a question, Westfall said. Nash would be on temporary duty in Hong Kong. There's no diplomatic immunity for TDY personnel if there's a flap, is there? Nate winced slightly. Westfall didn't know better. Nothing's perfect, said Holder. This is too big not to try. Westfall blinked at him. Holder pointed to a framed scroll with Chinese characters on the wall behind him. Know what that says? If I offend you, I'll help you pack. Old Confucian proverb. 8,400 kilometers east from Elwood Holder's headquarters office, Gelenzik Airport in Russia's Krasnodar Southern Federal District was bounded on the west by a low range of tree-covered maritime mountains, and on the east by the broad horseshoe-shaped Gelenzilskaya Bay, which emptied out into the Black Sea, a deep blue sheet of motionless glass this time of year. Dominica was met at the bottom of the stairs on the Sukhoi 100 by a blonde courtesy hostess, who looked sideways at the stunning, dark-haired woman who walked with a barely perceptible limp and who was dressed in what the hostess identified as the European style. She was going to the Cape, no one called it Putin's palace out loud, which meant she was someone important. But the tailored jacket, the shoes, the expensive sunglasses meant that she was neither from some clunky ministry in Moscow, nor one of the pneumatic hospitality greeters brought in for long weekend parties, the majority of whose clothing involved sequins or feathers. In Russia, people who do not fit into familiar categories are usually dangerous and best left alone. So the hostess said nothing as she made sure the unsmiling beauty was securely belted into her plush seat in the AW-139 VIP helicopter, closed the door, dogged down the handle, and stood with heels together and waved until the twin engines began a low growl and the rotors began turning, at which point she held on to her pillbox hat and ran. The helicopter rose, banked sharply, straightened out, and followed the rocky coast for 10 minutes before banking sharply again over a wooded peninsula that ended in a crumbling bluff down to the sea. Dominica caught a glimpse of a massive Italianate mansion surrounded by trees and flanked by formal geometric gardens that extended from the main house in all directions, Putin's palace. As they descended, she picked out paths through the forest that led to a dozen smaller houses, some of them perched on the edge of the seaside cliff. On land, another hostess with a clipboard, she was short, dark, and dour, rode with Dominica in the back seat of an electric cart behind two bullet heads in black suits. Since she had been gifted a luxurious dacha by her new patron, Vladimir, Vova was one diminutive of his name, a familiarity reserved for mothers, grandmothers, and mistresses, Dominica had followed Gorelikov's suggestion to fly down for the weekend to see the dacha and acknowledge the honor. The president earlier had told her about the gala event there in late fall, a time of glorious weather on the southern coast. "Friends and colleagues will gather there in early November for the Unity Day holiday on the 4th," Putin had said. Unity Day was a traditional holiday, reinstated in 2005, originally commemorating the Russian victory in 1612 over Polish invaders. An extra holiday and a few wreaths placed on the monuments kept the popular approval ratings up, and was cause for a 2-day bacchanal at Putin's palace. "I expect you to come and enjoy the scenery," said Putin with a half-smile first perfected in AD 41 by Caligula. "Go down there now and get the lay of the land," Gorelikov had added confidentially, rubbing his hands, blue halo pulsing. "It will impress the jealous ones that he gave you a dacha. They'll all assume the obvious and will be afraid of you." "He's grooming me to be director," thought Dominica. "I wonder when he will become my svodnik, my pimp." The dacha, her dacha, was a modern, stark three-story cement villa decorated in sleek Scandinavian style with swoopy chairs in white leather and stainless steel. The main floor consisted of a foyer, a living room with sliding glass doors that led to the balcony looking out over the cliff face and the sea, and a modern galley kitchen in white with stainless steel highlights. The top floor was one broad master bedroom with a 2-acre bed and its own picture window and balcony, while the bottom floor had 2 additional bedrooms and a small cedar-lined banya, a Russian steam room. Looking out over the balcony railing, Dominica could see a stony goat path beside the villa that hugged the cliff face and wound its way down to a boulder-strewn beach 70 meters below. The villa was perched on the side of the incline, and the balconies virtually soared over the cliff. "Bozh, God, this was beautiful." Dominica opened all the sliding doors to smell the sea air and the fragrant pines, took off her shoes, opened cupboard doors, bounced on the bed, and took off her jacket and skirt, and lay in her underwear, on a chaise lounge on the upper balcony in the warm October sun. She found a bottle of Georgian champagne in the small refrigerator and poured herself a glass, and sat outside again, looking at the distant sea and listening to the cicadas buzzing in the trees. There were no other houses visible, no man-made sounds at all. In Moscow it was almost freezing, and some frost dusted the rooftops. Here it was still summer. This was luxury, this was privilege, this was a universe away from the pall of Moscow. The sea breeze tossed the gauzy white curtains as Dominica stepped into the gray-tiled walk-in shower, and she sniffed at the rose-scented soap and let the hot water loosen her muscles, and she turned, trying to imagine Nate standing close, soaping her back, but Blokhin was there instead, grinning like Shaitan, water coursing off his face, his paws bloody, and Dominica shook the image away, suddenly cold despite the hot water, and closed her eyes. She bitterly realized that this modern villa soaring above the sea was Lipovi, literally a lime blossom, but figuratively it meant something false, a fake, a forgery. Her grandmother from St. Petersburg used to whisper to her stories from the Biblia, the book about temptation. This dacha was nothing more than Satan's plate of silver in the desert that tempted St. Anthony. Vladimir Putin would trade this house for her loyalty, the directorship of the SVR for her conscience, and her induction as a Silovik for her soul. She stood dripping wet in the shower, shivering. The villa now was gray and ugly, the sunlight harsh and revealing, the cicadas a painful buzzing in her ears. She had come this weekend out of curiosity to see her, dacha, to acknowledge Putin's gift, to get away from the crenellated walls of the Kremlin. Now, she knew there would be no rest in this cement lockbox. She would have to suffer a savorless night and return to Moscow tomorrow on the shuttle flight. Dressed in a light sweater dress and wearing flats, Dominica walked at dusk along the paved path toward the massive main house. Through the trees, she saw its light ablaze on every floor. The staff would be preparing for the upcoming Unity Day gala. As she walked in the failing light, she saw the cherry glow of a cigarette in the woods, then another on the other side. The grounds were swarming with security. A bruiser sat in a cart where the path crossed another. He watched her walk past him without nodding or acknowledging her. Putin's personal bodyguard belonged to the SBP, the Presidential Security Service, which was an autonomous element of the FSO, Federalnaya Slushba Okhrany, the Federal Protective Service, a reorganized agency loyal only to Vladimir Putin and tasked exclusively with the protection of the Russian Federation, which meant anything the Siloviki wanted it to mean. Dominica had heard the rumors about the president's outwardly blasé but secret fear of assassination, about the plastic containers of prepared meals sealed and signed by food tasters, and about the most trusted men of his protective detail, uncouth new millionaires who had been given blocks of shares in the state-run petroleum, manufacturing, and railroad conglomerates as a reward for their loyalty. She wondered if the towering irony was lost on Vladimir Putin that the leader of a modern nation with nuclear weapons and a space program feared political murder as the czars before him feared the silken stranger's cord. Even Joseph Stalin felt it. He was famously quoted as saying, "Do you remember the czar? Well, I'm like a czar." The meticulously manicured inner courtyard of the palace was massive. A white marble fountain bubbled in the center, and ropes of white lights hung from poles and were strung along the second-floor windows of the mansion. Dominica was directed to a small private dining room where she was served in silence by a waitress with downcast eyes. The selection of dishes went on for pages, with ingredients that were not to be found in all of Russia, not even in the five-star restaurants of Moscow or St. Petersburg. She chose a tuna carpaccio with grapefruit and fennel like she'd had in Rome, just to see what they would do with it. The tuna, sliced paper thin, came on a large chilled plate dusted with fennel fronds and drizzled with olive oil and balsamic vinegar. It was delicious. Dominica felt slightly ridiculous sitting alone in a little dining room, but the mansion and the entire compound, including outdoor amphitheater, spa club, screening room, indoor and outdoor pools, library, and massive barbecue deck, was deserted, the lull before the president and scores of guests arrived in November. She was resigned to walk back to her dacha through the dark, watched by eyes in the woods, and go to bed. She would think about Nate, as she always did at night, and wish he were there with her lying on the balcony chaise lounge, working on getting a moon burn. She got up from the table and walked down the hall toward the exit when she heard a voice behind her, calling an accented Russian. "Excuse me, miss, but do you have the time?" A young man in his 20s with dark hair and blue eyes was standing in an open door. He wore a work shirt and jeans, was muscular but thin, with strong forearms holding up either side of the door frame. His face was ruddy and unshaven, and his mouth was more like a woman's mouth with full lips. You are wearing a watch on your left wrist, said Dominica, intuitively replying in English. An instrument often put to use determining what time it is. This elicited a 1,000-watt smile from the young man, which was, Dominica had to admit, somewhat charming. You speak English, good. My Russian's terrible, he said, smiling. I was asking if you had the time to join us for a drink. Another incandescent smile, naughty, cherubic. There's no one around this place, and we've been here for 2 weeks. Intrigued, Dominica walked back toward him and peeked into the door. It was a cafeteria, a dining room for staff. Two other young men and two women were the only ones in the room, sitting at a table, littered with plates and glasses. Four empty wine bottles were clustered together. They were all smoking, and an overflowing ashtray was in the center of the table. The people around the table smiled. They were from Poland, and the young man held out a chair and poured her a glass of wine. Dominica introduced herself as a visiting event organizer, something vague. The charming young man was Andreas. He was the leader of the team from the Warsaw Academy of Fine Arts Department of Conservation and Restoration of Works of Art. He introduced his colleagues, all art restoration experts, attractive, attentive. Everyone spoke all at once, all smart, new generation Poles who knew English well. In the generation since the Soviets withdrew, East European schoolchildren no longer willingly studied Russian. The academy in Warsaw had been hired by Rosimushestvo, the Federal Agency for State Property Management, to do emergency restoration work in the mansion on a large number of ceiling and wall murals. Pipes in the walls had leaked or burst even as the palace was being completed, requiring restoration on a new building, which Dominica silently thought was a metaphor for the Russian Federation, broken before completed. The Poles had been working in the empty palace overseen by scowling security thugs and a cavalous Russian foreman, and had cabin fever. They were apparently unconcerned about speaking freely. The murals are ghastly, giggled Anka, a blonde. A Sardinian artist painted them when the place was built, said Stefan, with a serious face. Russians are the only ones who would think they were elegant. Anka shushed him with a slap on the arm. Dominica smiled to show she was not offended. It turns out that Russian plumbers connect pipes as well as Sardinians paint, said Andreas. They've had burst water pipes everywhere. A lot of panels were damaged, and we're here to repair the plaster and restore the paintings. Dominica sipped her wine, interested. Sitting at the table with these fresh-faced Poles, their country once a satellite state but now eagerly facing the challenges of a future where many things were possible, Dominica thought of her mother and her tiny state-provided Moscow apartment, with the sooty, heat-curdled wallpaper over the radiators that were always lukewarm, never hot, and her late father's university photo on the mantelpiece, alongside the photo of her mother standing in the great hall of the Moscow Conservatory, serenely receiving applause, her violin under her arm, and the little wooden box on the outside windowsill to keep food colder than any freezer, and the tiny table with an open tin of sardinka, sardines in oil flecked with blood, a day-old heel of black bread, spread with white lard instead of butter. This is what the munificence of Vladimir Putin had given the people of Russia, while water cascaded down the frescoes of his Black Sea palace. How much longer will you be here? She asked. They're getting ready for a big gathering in November. The Poles rolled their eyes. We know. That smelly foreman is always telling us to work faster, said Stefan. But there's too much damage. We'll probably need more people to come from Warsaw. The Russians don't care, and they pay what we ask. We've heard this is the president's house. It's best not to speculate, said Dominica with a wink. The Poles all laughed. It was a merry party. A glass of wine later, Andreas asked Dominica if she would like to see some of the murals they were working on. They walked up a magnificent double spiral staircase into a series of long corridors with vaulted painted ceilings. Every light seemed to be on, but the palace was deserted. Where was security? Aluminum scaffolding ran along one water-stained wall. Plastic sheets were taped everywhere. Andreas stood close to one panel, his long fingers tracing a line, his face intent. This is just mechanical restoration, a matter of renewing new pigment that has been damaged. It is nothing like restoring an altar screen painted by Giotto in 1305. Nothing. Domenica saw the fire in his eyes. He turned and caught her looking at him and colored slightly. You should see how special it can be. Following the master's brushstrokes, cleaning the dirt and varnish of the ages, seeing the blue he mixed with his own hand come back to the light. It's magical. He bashfully avoided looking at her. They walked from one grand room to the next, gold leaf glimmering in the bright light, chandeliers hanging heavy, one after the other along the endless length of the rooms. Exquisite ceramic bowls filled glass-fronted armoires, and silk drapes were tied back with satin ropes. Farther down the corridor, Andreas put his hand lightly on Domenica's shoulder, cocked his head, and opened a massive double door. They entered an enormous bedroom with a gilded ceiling, intricate parquet floors, and a massive canopy bed draped with brocaded curtains. Antique furniture filled the room, the boudoir of the Sun King. We had to repair the medallions on the ceiling, Andreas said, looking up. This is the president's bedroom. What do you think? It's grand, isn't it? Said Domenica, noncommittally. There was a possibility that those rooms were monitored somehow. Andreas bent toward her and whispered in her ear. I think it's obscene, he said. No one should live like this, not with how people in your country struggle. He straightened, looked at her, and smiled. But I'm just an art technician. What do I know? An hour later, Andreas's slim body glowed in the moonlight, slanting through the sliding doors of her dacha. Domenica lay on top of him, her back bathed in sweat, her toes cramping, and her hair pointing in all directions. For an art technician, you know quite a lot, she said. It had come in a rush beyond her control. No, she had not wanted to control it. Andreas had walked her back to the dacha and had accepted a glass of champagne. Domenica was in a state. The opulence of Putin's palace had sickened her, and all the gold leaf had stuck in her throat. Her life was chaos. She was surrounded by Gorelikov's poisonous charm and by Putin's covetousness and by the unrelenting pressure of being a spy and by Benford's misanthropy and by the tear in her heart over Bratok and by the uncertain ache for Nate and, short, goddammit, by being alone, always alone, beset with requirements and assignments, each one more critical or more urgent or more deadly than the last. The Kremlin was still the hoggish preserve of larcenous usurpers who with each year, with each stolen ruble, doomed her Russia to future deprivations as vast as the Siberian tundra. These hogs and this hog palace, they belonged in Skotobojnia, an abattoir. Her head swam as she had walked up to Andreas, put her hand behind his neck and mashed her mouth on his. There was no thought of being a sparrow and no thought about her genuine love for Nate, and she didn't care what Andreas thought, and she paid no heed to the conventions. She just wanted passion and juddering haunches and the taste and smell of him, and she locked her heels behind his back and kissed him until the pipes broke and melted the murals and set her legs to shaking. Later, she hoped she hadn't bitten his lower lip too badly. Andreas didn't know who she was or what exactly had happened, but the jungle survival instinct in his forebrain told him he probably shouldn't spend the night. Domenica didn't care when he tiptoed out. What Bratok Gable had once called to horizontalize was what she had needed. Thinking about Gable reminded her of how much she missed him. Then thinking about Bratok made her think of the faceless mole in Washington who, if Benford didn't catch him, would soon be reading her name on a list of CIA's Russian clandestine assets, and the FSB arrest teams in their black Skoda vans would fan out through Moscow, and men with faces like canines would ring doorbells and pull suspects down the stairwells and into the vans for the drive to Lefortovo, where their guilt would soon be established. Domenica wondered if she shouldn't start sleeping in her clothes, so she wouldn't be in a nightgown when they dragged her into the street. Tuna Carpaccio. Chill a 10-inch plate. Slice raw bluefin tuna very thinly, then pound paper thin under a layer of plastic wrap, and layer plate with slices. Keep chilled. Slice fennel bulb paper thin and mix with grapefruit supremes and salt. Finely grate ginger. sprinkle ginger on tuna slices, then heap fennel and grapefruit in the center of the plate, and sprinkle chopped shallots and chopped fennel fronds on top. Drizzle with olive oil and balsamic vinegar, and sprinkle with sea salt. Serve immediately. Chapter 24. Feel Mint for You. Nate's flight to Hong Kong required an overnight stay in Los Angeles. Since the advent of commercial air, all U.S. government employees assigned overseas were required by regulation to fly American to better support domestic airline companies, unfortunately at the cost of U.S. taxpayers. This invariably resulted in not only more expensive tickets, but also inconvenient schedules, routes, and connections. But the rule was ironclad. Nate's morning flight from Washington, D.C. would arrive in Los Angeles before noon, and he would have the entire day rattling around the city. Then he thought of Agnes Krawcheck and the white streak in her hair. Since the mission to Sevastopol, they had stayed in touch via email and two or three uncomfortable phone calls. Agnes had wanted to visit Nate in Washington, but ops meetings with Dominica were imminent, so Nate put her off. They had spoken more frequently recently, and they'd made vague plans to see each other. Then the Hong Kong clam bake came up. Agnes had settled in coastal Palos Verdes, south of Los Angeles, a semi-rural suburb of undulating hills and craggy oceanside bluffs covered with eucalyptus, cinnamon, and pepper trees, and populated by artists, aging flower children from the 60s, and 1,000 feral India blue peacocks. She lived in a comfortable two-bedroom craftsman-style house with fieldstone columns supporting a front porch and flower pots in the windows. With art restoration experience from her native Poland, Agnes had been hired by the Getty Museum in Brentwood as a conservator. Her specialty was 16th-century Italian altar panels. When Nate called Agnes to tell her he'd be in Los Angeles for the day and to invite her to lunch, she told him to stop talking nonsense. She would pick him up at the airport, she would give him lunch at her house where he would stay the night, and she would bring him back to the airport the next morning in time for his onward flight. That was the plan, no arguments. Ever the pro, she didn't ask where he was going or why. Nate struggled with competing emotions. He knew the career reprieve bestowed by Benford was dependent on his continued good behavior and on the successful recruitment of the profligate General Tan Feren in Macau. Stopping in Los Angeles and seeing Agnes did not seem to Nate to constitute unacceptable behavior, but he was unsure if Benford would view it as recidivism. He likewise struggled with the situation with Dominica. With Benford breathing fire and Dominica's refusal to contemplate retirement before the unspeakable happened and she was caught, were they finished? Would they ever even see each other again, much less be together? Nate knew he loved her. That had not changed. But he faced the possibility that she might truly be out of his life as permanently as if she had been caught putting down a drop in Moscow, tried, and executed in the basement of Butyrka prison. Mortification over his recent professional missteps had morphed into loneliness and a desire to be able to talk to a friend. Gable was gone, Benford was unapproachable, and Forsyth had his own problems as a division chief. Seeing Agnes perhaps would be a salve to his screwed-up emotions. She was smart, brave, earthy, and even, pushing 50, impossibly sexy. She knew the work, she knew the life, she understood. And judging by the response to his call, she still liked him. He looked forward to being with her as a friend. Agnes was in the brightly colored Mazatlan Mayan woven hammock hung from the overhanging eaves of her little house in her small moonlit backyard. Bamboo tiki torches, guttering and stinking of kerosene, cast jumpy shadows on the flagstone patio and on the ferns, cacti, and flowering bushes that filled the garden. It would have been a more bucolic scene had Agnes not been lying naked across the width of the hammock, with her toes hooked into the ropes, her legs extended out in a V, swinging the thing back and forth, each upswing bringing her mons into contact with an equally naked Nate, standing a foot away on the flagstones, braced for each collision, while desperately calculating trajectory and windage for the next kinetic docking. Agnes's head hung over the other side of the hammock as she moaned, Mosnie, which Nate only later found out meant harder in Polish, which was just as well because any harder would have knocked him backward into the ornamental fish pond. Later, in a short belted kimono, Agnes showed Nate a wooden panel, part of a 1534 altar from a chapel in Florence that may or may not have been painted by a student of Michelangelo. She had a deadline and had been given permission to bring it home to work on it. "I'm keeping you from your work," said Nate. Agnes smiled, shook her hair, and put her hands on his shoulders. "Michelangelo I can see every day," she said. "You're here now with me in my little house, and that's all I need. Do you remember what I told you in Romania? Chuye miete drasibie. I feel mint for you. I have feelings for you." She brushed a strand of hair off her forehead and leaned to kiss him, slowly at first, then more urgently. She suddenly stopped and looked him in the eyes. "Is that other woman still in your life?" Agnes asked. "I can still feel you carry her inside." Nate had forgotten how perceptive Agnes was. She didn't have a witch's white forelock for nothing. "It's still very difficult," said Nate. "It involves work, and it didn't go well. I may have put her in danger, and that's inexcusable." "I hope she is safe," Agnes said softly. "I miss the work, the excitement. I miss the old colleagues, and I miss Poland." She was silent for a moment. "I won't ask you any more about her. I am glad you came. Are you hungry? Come and watch me." They went into the kitchen, where Agnes quickly prepared foil-baked salmon and a Polish cucumber salad called miseria, misery, because it was a staple of peasants. They sat outside in the dark, eating by torchlight, Agnes watching Nate's face as he ate. Beyond the garden fence, a peacock shrilled its creepy mating call that sounds like a soprano trilling, "Help me, help me." The last time I heard a peacock howl like that, I was in the woods in northern Greece, meeting someone special, said Nate. Scared me to death at the time. Agnes leaned forward, her chin in her hands, smiling at him. "I do not think you are scared very easily," said Agnes. "I don't know. Feels like I'm scared more now than when I was younger," said Nate. "That's what experience does to you, I guess." "Do I scare you?" Agnes asked. "No, Agnes, I think you're wonderful," said Nate. Her eyes were shiny with emotion, and Nate felt a wave of tenderness welling up inside him. "When you return, it would be nice to have you visit longer, take a vacation," she said. "I could sneak you into the museum workshop and show you the Medici panels. They are special." She searched his eyes for a reaction. "I'd love that," said Nate. "But no more of that hammock. I think I have a hip pointer." "What is a hip pointer?" Agnes said. Nate got up and put her hand on his bruised hip bone. "See? Hammocks are out, please." "I have hurt you? Yeni kochane. Oh, dear. What can I do to relieve your pain?" she said, mock concerned. Nate kissed her, and she pressed against him, nuzzling his neck and softly biting his lower lip. He held her by the hand and led her to her bedroom, where Agnes flopped onto the bed on her back. Nate stood over her, slowly undoing his belt buckle. From outside, the peacock called, "Help me. Help me." "I know how that bird feels," said Agnes, untying the belt of her kimono. Nate took the airport express from Czech Lapkok Airport, looking out the window as the train rocked past emerald blue lagoons and the dark green peaks of the islands scattered in the South China Sea. The gleaming downtown rail terminal in central Hong Kong was a beehive of orderly activity. The rank of cherry-red taxis waited for passengers, and the rear doors of the vehicles swung open automatically at the push of a button, striking Nate as quintessentially Chinese, welcoming foreigners to the Orient with a bow. The taxi raced through the teeming downtown business district, sidewalks jammed with pedestrians and delivery men pushing carts stacked with boxes. The cab rocketed up steeply curving Garden Road and came to a squealing stop in front of the U.S. consulate, a four-story concrete box with square-tinted windows, the American flag hanging limply in the humid air. Nate slid his passport under the receptionist's glass. She was a foreign service national, a local Hong Konger, and was buzzed through to the Marine Security Guard Post 1, where Nate's passport again was examined by a young steely Marine in blue dress sea uniform, a crisp khaki shirt and necktie, and a holstered sidearm at his hip.